Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore, brought to you by Blinkist, where you'll find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes, so you can test drive them or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, at Blinkist.com. Today's guest is a master of many domains, a proverbial polymath, as the Brits would say. He has been a world-class photographer, ad man, self-improvement guru. He's known as the father of the modern human potential movement. Corporate improvement guru, as I like to call it. He's the originator of the MasterCard Priceless ad campaign, which resulted from a consulting gig he did with MasterCard. The writer of many books, seven or so that he and I published together, and a world-class coffee aficionado and consultant. Stuart and I have known each other for, a little over 20 years. And I have been the beneficiary of many great conversations with him, some of which were fortified by a libation or two. Stuart, great to have you here again today.
Well, I'm happy to be back. Thank you so much. I always enjoy these, and hopefully people who listen to them enjoy them too. But more importantly, they're going to make a better life for themselves as a result of something they pick up along the way in the podcast. So if that happens, that would be just terrific. So welcome, everybody. Well,
I've gotten a lot of good comments from people that I know about your other podcast, Stuart. So, yes, I do know that people are getting a good vibe and are learning stuff. Stuart, today we wanted to talk about a book that we published together 16 years ago, and it was called Success Built to Last, Creating a Life That Matters. Success Built to Last was a sequel in some respects to Jerry Porras and Jim Collins' Built to Last back in 1990. And many of the concepts which underlie Success Made to Last, our podcast, come from that book. And so I figured it'd be good for us to talk about that today, since we hadn't really done that explicitly. And but Stuart, as a preface to our discussion about that book, talk about the interviews that you and Mark and Jerry did as research for the book, some 200 or 300 interviews. Talk about some of the people you interviewed, your methodology, and and going through all that massive information in whatever other context that you want to provide us, as context as we lead into the book itself.
Well, I think I'd like to talk about the great variety of people who were interviewed. I think Mark Thompson did the bulk of the interviews, and then Jerry and I split the rest. But between the three of us, we interviewed such a varied cast of very successful people. We had the obligatory billionaires like Sir Richard Branson and Michael Dell, Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison. I mean, we went down a long list of billionaires. We talked about people who were billionaires in the sense that they had touched the lives of billions of people on Earth, people like Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Oprah, Maya Angelou, and then people who were scientists and had, through that, touched the lives of billions of people. So another way of looking at this concept of a billionaire, people like Ed Penoit, who'd founded a bioscience company and had ultimately developed the AIDS vaccine as a result of the research that they did. So this is a great variety of people. And the purpose in all of the interviews was to find out what the secret sauce was. Is success a talent you're born with, or is success a skill that you can learn? And what we discovered in all of that is success is highly overrated. You could almost argue that, people used to say that talent is born and not made. And, we'd be a contrarian to the extent that what most people think of as talent is made and not born. Because what most people think of as talent are people who are talented, we say, because they are exhibiting extraordinary skills. So we say, well, Steph Curry, if you're in the basketball, or Michael Jordan are extraordinarily talented. But what's missed in that is a couple of things. One, it's demotivating, because if you think it was talent that these chaps were born with, you're inclined to say that, well, it's over for you because you weren't born with that talent. But once you get an insight into the lives of these people, which you could have with Michael Jordan in the Last Dance, you just see the extraordinary level of work that he put in to become the best in the world at the time at doing something that he loved. And so if there was a secret sauce to all of the people we interviewed to appear in Success Built to Last, it was that they had found something that they loved to do, and they put in the work to develop extraordinarily levels of skill, or what we call mastery, to become, in many cases, the best in the world at it. And so that was the biggest takeaway of all, I think. And it didn't vary. And I suppose one other thing we discovered was we always thought, well, it'll be just one thing. Like Curly in City Slickers, when he held up the finger and said, well, the secret of life is just one thing. You got to know what the one thing is.
And then he died.
And they died, yes. So, oh, well, timing, right? So anyhow, what we found with these people was it wasn't just one thing. And I think that was described or stated most eloquently by Maya Angelou, who said to Mark Thompson, you know, Mark, it's never been just one thing with me. I've got a portfolio of passions. And in having a portfolio of passions, she said, you know, I couldn't write if I didn't dance. I couldn't dance if I didn't write. I couldn't teach if I didn't dance and write. And she went through a list of things that really mattered to her. And she said, you know, for her, being good at the things she loved most was at the intersection of practicing all of the things that she loved, or the things that she loved most. And so we found that to be an underlying principle. Now, people who have that quality, who invest in a number of passions, who invest in becoming good at a variety of things, in the days of famous Florence, of the great masters, that was called Renaissance people. But today we call them polymaths, and actually the term polymath was around before the term a Renaissance person. They called them Renaissance men, but we have to say Renaissance person now, because a lot of these people were extraordinary female people. So that's a long answer to that short question, Tim, but there you have it.
Well, most good answers have layers of meaning. Stuart, for a moment, also, you know, talk about the fact that, and I think it's important, you know, as part of your research process, you guys didn't go out, like a lot of researchers do, looking for an answer through your questions, A, and B, you didn't have a preset set of questions. You had some notions in mind, of course, but you let the person you were speaking to sort of, orient the conversation as it went along, and you were a guide, but it wasn't sort of a pro forma conversation. Talk a little bit about that and why it was valuable.
Well, I think that it was Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman said, you know, science is a recognition of the incompetence of experts. I'm paraphrasing it a little bit, but or the ignorance of experts. And I think we went out to learn something. We were clear about what we wanted to learn. We wanted to learn, is there some deep underlying organizing principle to these enduringly successful people, one. And two, if there is, can you learn whatever it is, or can you acquire whatever it is, or can you in some way become the recipient of whatever that is, so you too can become enduringly successful? Can you, we take that, what we learn, and put it together in such a way and offer it to people in such a way that they can embrace it and use, practice it to become enduringly successful? And that was the intent. So when you go out with the intent, you clearly don't know the answer when you start, and you don't have a criteria that the answer must conform to other than you hope that it meets the requirements that you set out to gather, that what you discover is acquirable, is transferable, can be put to use by yourself and other people. And so that was the mindset, if you want to call it that, that we went out with. It was a genuine exploration, a genuine experiment. You know, we define an experiment as something you do to see what happens if you do it, you know. And you hope you get a good outcome, but not always. I think we got a good outcome, very good outcome, actually.
Yes, and then we'll talk about it later, but we did do some science at the end. And the science.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead and talk about it now, because is always worth talking about.
Yeah, Howard Moskowitz is just one of those, you know, this is to be that series, the most interesting character I ever met. Howard, be on that list.
Yes,
I just loved him a bunch, but he was one of the world's great researchers and mostly put the commercial use like, what's the secret to Heinz ketchup and why can't anybody make ketchup the way Heinz does, or at least achieve that level of popularity? But he went out, and Howard's methodology was pretty simple. Not simple, but sophisticated, but that often is the case with simple things. That he would ask people a series of questions because he knows that people don't tell pollsters the truth a lot of the time. So he would ask people a series of questions in such a way that it introduced what we call cognitive dissonance. And then in trying to resolve the dissonance, because people don't like dissonance, they would offer up answers to questions that let him get at the truth of what was really going on for them or with them. So he designed a set of questions that we sent out to us thousands and thousands of people all over the earth to see what was success to them and did it matter to them and was it important to them and what actually did matter to them. And to our great pleasure, what came back in the way of answers was a confirmation of what we'd learned from these people we'd interviewed. We got down to becoming really, really good at doing something that you love to do. And for most people, you know, I wanted to put that to the use of making the world a better place. And this was we people we interviewed.
Well, and anyone out there who doesn't know who Howard Moskowitz is, just go to YouTube and Google Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell's TED Talk, which is now 15 years old at least, was the first of the TED Talks that really just went viral and a million people listened to it. And it's about 18 minutes, if I remember correctly, on Howard. Howard was quite a character, a true mad scientist. By the way, Stuart, after our last conversation about him, I looked him up, and he's still alive. So
we should track him down for old time's sake. Yeah, we would be nice to interview him for this series.
Yes, he was a master. He's one of the greats. And Stuart, you know, through the interviews, you discovered backing up just a second. You used the term enduringly successful four or five times already. And you know, talk about that, what that means, and B, those are the only kinds of people you chose to talk to. You didn't talk to flashes in the pan because they're not interesting because they're not builders over time.
No, I mean, we used to call people like that in the motivational speaking business Sammy and Sally skyrockets, right? They go to a motivational talk. They get all turned on for 30 seconds or at least a couple of days. They do something great, and then they crash and burn. That's the end of it. And so a couple of things. Yes, in the book, we call people with enduring success as people who are able to build something. Now, mostly insuccess built the last. They had built big companies or they built big movements. But I think people listening to this podcast, and I think for me personally these days, how do you build enduring personal success? And what does that actually mean? And it's not just about the money. You know, a cynic might say, well, the old saying was, it's not just the money, it's the interesting people you meet. And cynics would say, well, it's not just the people, it's the interesting money you meet. But at the end of the day, it's not an either or. And I think that only us people who thought of themselves as being successful, they would define wealth as opposed to money. They would define wealth as having as much as they felt that they needed without the fear of losing that or not having that. And mostly they had that level of comfort around what we'll call wealth because they really were clear in their own ability to create value in the world. So, you know, people who make money, distinct from people who inherit it or win it in a game or a lottery, people who create for themselves monetary wealth, material wealth, do so because they did something or they had a skill or they built something that people valued and gave them money for. So it's like a pretty simple idea. So, people pretty much divide themselves into, well, the way I'm going to become successful is I'm going to get people to give me something. But they don't get the step in exchange for creating value. And so all of these people who are enduringly successful had pretty much figured out how to create a life that was a gift to the world and that gave people valued. And I suppose not a gift in the sense that they gave it away for free, but a gift to the sense that whatever they did provide to the world or offer to the world created such an extraordinary level of value that they were generously rewarded for having done that. And so we say to people, you want to build enduring success, find something you love to do, get really, really, really good at it, and pick something to do that adds value to the world. Now, this can be a long conversation, but people find their own way. It doesn't have to be you're going to bring world peace and solve world hunger and clean up the environment by tomorrow night. That's not what we're saying. But I have found that people, you know, writers or artists, they get a sense of creating value for the world. People love their art and give them money for that. And so they're really clear that they're able to create value for which they'll be rewarded monetarily at a level that meets their needs. And they don't suffer from the fear of those needs not being met.
And that, Stuart, is a really good description of this thing, this person that you met along the way that you call the builder.
Correct.
Someone who builds a life that matters and that is enduringly matters. And you call that person a builder. And you refer in the book consistently to that person as the builder. And so you've gotten to that concept without me asking for it, and that's great because I wanted to make sure we covered that before we jumped too far downstream. You also identify three elements in the book, Stuart, and that are elements of, you know, a life built, enduringly successfully, however one defines success. And these three elements must all be in harmony. And they are meaning, thinking, or what you call thought styles, and action. Talk about meaning and what it is and why it matters.
Yeah, so one of the challenges of meaning is that the idea of meaning, it's a resource that lives within you that you invest in something. So some of the philosophers will say that, you know, things have no meaning but the meaning that you give them. So societally, we have what's called narratives that we live by. And those narratives help members of the society decide what matters and what doesn't matter. And they're people who live in what Keegan calls, they live in a mind state of the socialized mind. And then you get people who they're just going to do it their way, as Frank Sinatra would say. And so they're deciding for themselves what has meaning. And then there's what Keegan calls the self-transforming mind, where you're trying to find meaning beyond your own biases and beliefs. But ultimately, meaning is a resource within you which you invest. So if you're going to do something, you're the person who decides that's meaningful to you. And if what you're doing is sufficiently meaningful to enough people and you're sufficiently good at it, then you'll be rewarded for that. So that's the thing about meaning. People are searching for meaning, but the fact of the matter is, if you're searching for meaning, you've got to look in the mirror. You've got to look inside yourself and say, this is what matters to me. And what matters to me and what matters to you may be different things. But if we're both in service of what matters to us, and in that service of what matters to us, we generally move the world what we call in the direction of goodness, that we're not taking more from the world than we're creating in the way of value, then that's going to turn out on the meaning level. And then there's the thing about thought style. So that the simplest, biggest distinction in successful people on thought styles is, if we make oversimplicity two categories, we have what we call victim mentality. It's a victim thought style. The world is doing it to me. Or there's the, I'm accountable. I'm responsible. I can respond to the world and create value. That's my choice. And so that's a thought style thing. Now the thought styles get more complex than that. So do I have an inquiring thought style? Am I a curious thought style? We talk about it a lot, but effective thought styles begin with the notion that I am not a victim in the world. If I bought into, if I believe, if I've allowed somebody to sell me I'm a victim and that I have no control over my future or what happens to me, then there's no chance of us living and creating and building a successful life for ourselves or anybody else. And you can get into very difficult conversations about this because there's people who really do look like victims. So I'll tell a very short story. I was talking to a woman who had survived ethnic cleansing in an African nation. And her grandmother, who was going blind, was an authority on mushrooms. She was the mushroom whisperer. And so she and her granddaughter survived by living on mushrooms, which men wouldn't eat because they couldn't tell the difference between the ones that would nourish you and the ones that would poison you. Mm-hmm. So they do this and they build a business, growing mushrooms. And it turns out that mushrooms grow best on coffee compost. So now they're in the coffee business. So they come to the United States as the guests of my friends at Equator Coffee. Equator Coffees and Teas, who a year or two ago won the distinction of having the best coffee in the world. So I spoke to this this woman, and I said, okay, so how do you – I know you took all these orphans in. And you're teaching them to build a business growing mushrooms. And I know you've come here to try and get that to work in East Oakland. I said, so tell me, what's the social contract with these orphans who come in who've had, they've survived ethnic cleansing. Their parents have been killed. They have nothing. You bring them in, what's the deal? And she says, pretty straightforward. I tell them, look, we're all here and we've come from a horrendous past. And I'm going to teach you how to build a great future for yourself and for your community. But if I ever hear you or catch you using your horrendous past as an excuse and a reason for not seeking to achieve in the present and going forward into the future, I'll throw you out of this community. Wow. And I said, how's it working here? She said, well, you know, it's very hard to do this with resource-challenged people in America because they've been sold and they're believers in their victimhood. And to get them to relinquish that narrative is incredibly difficult because there's endless social support for that mindset. So she said, I found that, you know, wherever I go in the world, if I'm taking people and attempting to lift them up, I have to get them to let go of them being victims and as an excuse for an unsuccessful life. They're pretty harsh words and probably not socially popular here in this environment at the moment. And I hope my having expressed it doesn't get the podcast into trouble. But I'm not expressing my particular point of view on the matter. I'm simply quoting an extraordinary woman.
Yes, you know, you and I have talked over the years about Carol Dweck's book, Mindset.
Yeah.
You know, there are two kinds of people in the world, she posits. The first kind of person is perceives that their talents are bounded and that they're typically swayed by the world, that the world controls their outcomes, and that's a victim mentality. And the other person is the person of abundance, has an abundance mentality. And that person believes that their talents can expand over time, that they could learn more, they can do more, they can be more, and that the world is something that they can move in the direction, as you would say, of goodness. And those people, you know, and you can see that, speaking of being politically incorrect, but you can see that in the different lives of two different Somali women. One is Ayan Hirsi Ali, who fits the latter of the categories, and the second is Ilhan Omar, both of whom came from Somalia, and both of whom have followed different directions. So it's the bad news about the, you know, as Carol says in her book, the bad news about the bounded person is that is a race to the bottom. There is nowhere to go but down. And the good news about the Ayan Hirsi Alis of the world is that they can, you know, they are motivated by a passion or a sense of meaning, and they can help the world, you know, get better in incremental ways. So I think I love that story. I've heard you tell it many times, and it's remarkable that a person, you know, it's like the people, the Holocaust, you know, survivors, like Elie Wiesel or you know, this Stockdale, you know, when he was in the Hanoi Hilton, you know, coming out and saying that he frankly thought he was glad that he spent that time. And you scratch your head and you say, man, that was mine. But he found a kind of meaning that, you know, the rest of us will probably never find, and in a way, but we're probably, you know, so fortunate for that. Stuart, you talk about meaning, and you know, a lot of people talk about passions, but meaning's bigger than passions. I mean, meaning is values, and meaning is, you know, is connected to the outer world. Well, passions can be, you know, somewhat selfish. I mean, is there something there to talk about, or am I frankly wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. It's a more complicated conversation, so I tend to think of passion as being more unidimensional, and the concept of meaning is more inclusive of all of the elements that make up our sensibilities, one of which is our passion or our ability to experience being passionate. But meaning is almost at the level of the soul. It's the level of the spirit. And it propels action over time. Passion tends to ebb and flow. But a commitment to meaning that informs and empowers action, that's really something, and that's the kind of meaning we're talking about. So we didn't get to the action step, did we? So
okay, we'll get there.
Yeah. So I think that's enough about the difference between meaning and passion. Just that passion, I just think, is more monochromatic than meaning, and that meaning includes passion.
And I think that's my sense too. Yes.
And I've seen people being passionate, and I'm damned if I can see any meaning involved. You know what I mean?
I think I have a feeling that I know what you're talking about. You know that?
Right. Yeah, we're talking biology, right.
Stuart, there's, so many, self-improvement books, videos, things, and people talk about, these concepts as if the reader were 18 years old, and thinking about, the journey that goes forward from there. And, what is it that, what gives them meaning in life, and, what are they going to do with their life that gives them meaning, et cetera, et cetera. But what about the middle-aged person who's sitting there at 40, 43 or so, and says,
is that middle-aged? That's pretty scary.
Well, it used to be, about 30 something, right? But it's gotten up there more, but whatever. In any case, that person sitting there listening to the two of us pontificate and wax eloquent and says, you guys are out of your mind. I got three kids. I got a mortgage. I got college bills looming in the future. I'm gonna have to pay for the rest of my life. And you want to tell me about meaning and passions and following them? What does one say to that person? To help them understand that this isn't gobbledygook.
Well, one of my favorite stories and came from Success Built to Last, and I think you told it to us because you did a deal with this guy that was Tom Clancy. And Tom Clancy married a lady which placed him into the family insurance business. He wasn't the Geico lizard. He was just this guy in the insurance business, feeling about as comfortable in it and as out of place in it as a real lizard would be, right? And so in his spare time, he would write. And he had this, enormous stack of rejection letters, but it didn't deter him because he really liked to write. Now, to this day, people said, he never really turned into a great writer, but he was a great storyteller, and there's a difference. And he wrote a little book called The Hunt for Red October. And I remember some years going back, the company you formerly represented, Mr. Moore, paid him like a $250 million for rights to the brand. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't mind it. Yeah, when a dollar was really a dollar. So a couple of lessons in all of that. One, he was responsible for meeting his daily obligations as a member of a family with a large insurance business. And two, he honored something that he loved to do. I don't think he had any idea that it would develop into what it became. But he wrote every day because he liked to do that. And if you write every day, sometimes what you like to do is send it out to people, hoping they'll print it, and somebody else will like what you wrote. And, you know, we had Seth Godin on this morning on another thing that I was on. Seth said to me, he said, you know, I would write my blog every day whether you read it or you didn't. He said, I write it because I need to write it for me. It turns out people love it. Well, that's great. Now I'm playing a little loosey-goosey with his exact words, but that was the message. And last time I checked, he had probably the most read blog on earth. And he's a lovely man. He's gentle and just really a nice man. So if we get back to the person saying, well, I've got this job that I don't like all that well, and I got these responsibilities, I've got kids and a wife, or as Saul but a Greek would say, a full catastrophe, and I'm trying to cope with that. And the way that Clancy coped with it was just something that he loved to do that was a hobby to begin with. And he was good at it. I think the other bit of great advice, I asked Ed Penowitt, who found we spoke to before. He'd been a professor of biochemistry at UC Berkeley, had the chair. And he left to start a biotech company. But he'd say, you know, graduate students would come to me and say, well, is there any advice you can give me that might do us some good after we leave here? He said, well, when you leave here, you'll probably quickly find out that the rest of the world isn't like the UC Berkeley campus. And he said, so I'll say this to you. The only advice I've ever given anybody that did them any good is that whatever you've got to do and that's put in front of you, be committed to doing it really, really, really well. He said, you know, I was in a Chinese restaurant on University Avenue, and I opened a fortune cookie, and it said, whatever you are, be a good one. And I'm thinking, gee, Abraham Lincoln said that. What's it doing in a Chinese fortune cookie? Well, we know how that goes these days. So there it is, co-opted into a Chinese fortune cookie. But he said, I realized, boy, that's actually the best advice you could give anybody. Even if whatever you are being in this moment isn't your passion, isn't the thing that you love, at least if you're doing it with the commitment of becoming really good at it, you'll learn a couple of really important things. One, how to get good at something. Because they don't teach you how to get good at something in graduate school. They give you information, and information is and of itself isn't transformational. It takes skill to turn information into transformation and to allow you to build something with it. He said, so you need to learn how to get good at something, because otherwise when you find your thing, you won't know how to get good at it in time for having found it to do you much good. Yeah, so the other thing is, he said, you know, if people look at you and they see you doing something that isn't your thing, so you're not really committed to doing it well, they won't take any notice of you other than say, well, that's Charlie, you know, he just doesn't put any effort into things. But if you're the person who, no matter what you're doing, even if it isn't what you're into, but you're in committed to doing it really, really well, people look at you and say, you know, I just really like Charlie. I can't imagine that he really likes having to clean up the lab when he's finished doing his experiments, but he's just really committed to doing it perfectly. And when you're that kind of person, the word gets around and suddenly doors will open for you that you didn't even know were there to be opened. And along the way, one of those doors will open into your thing, or who knows, your thing may not have been invented yet, and you may even be one of the people who invent it. But when you find it, you really want to know how to get good at it. So I think one of the great skills that we try to talk about in the Success Book The Last is learn how to get good at something, even if it's not your something yet. So if you've got this job and you get really, really good at it, you'll get promoted, obviously. Or if it's your business will flourish. And along the way, given the fact that we all live longer than most companies these days, I mean, I remember when I came to America, grandparents wanted to live their children's stock in Polaroid and Kodak. Well, that didn't turn out so well. Today, we outlive companies for the most part. So we'll have multiple careers, probably. We might work for multiple companies or do multiple startups. And so the most important skill to have is the skill of being able to get good at something, becoming skillful at something to the level of mastery. And you just start somewhere.
And that's a great answer, Stuart, because even if you don't, even if the doors don't open and you become, Richard Branson, you've at the very least made your life a better gift to the world. And by the way, Stuart, you know, my career now as a Pearson, you know, followed that model. I did a lot of things. You know, I enjoyed doing them, but they weren't necessarily the things that I really cared about. But I cared about them. They just weren't like, you know, at the meta level. And suddenly someone said to me, you know, you want to publish books? Which I said, well, I've never published a book. You know, I've been on the sales and marketing side. And they said, don't worry, you'll be fine. And that was my favorite job ever. And frankly, it aligned perfectly with who I am. And I'm still doing it today, aren't I? It's just called podcasting now instead of publishing. So these things do happen. They're not just things for 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds. And I'm glad that you answered that, because I think a lot of people listen to this stuff that we were talking about, and they think, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, they're talking about, you know, the greats, and I'm not going to be one of the greats. But I'm not one of the greats, but I'm, you know, really good at a few things, and it gives me great pleasure. And as my old friend Father Nickerson would say, you know, at the end of the day, when I pour myself a gin and tonic, I'm able to look around the world, even in its shabby state right now, and say, it's a great world.
Yeah.
Stuart, I'm going to take a break here just for a moment, and I'm going to read some copy from our sponsor, and that will take me about a minute, and then we'll come back to you. And so folks out there in podcast land, let me tell you about a great way to learn new things and keep up on the topics that most interest you. It's a new app called Blinkist. This is very cool, by the way. It works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information, from thousands of nonfiction books and condenses them down to just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Now, you say to yourself, well, wait a minute here. I like to read books from cover to cover. Well, so do I. But I use Blinkist to test drive books I think I might be interested in. I read the condensed version, and you know, I find out if I'm actually that interested in it. And if my interest is piqued, I go and buy the book. However, for many books, you know, they may be at the edge of the things that really matter to me. Those books, all I do is read the condensed version. And that's great, too. So with Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read and listen to their massive library. All the books you want for one low price. Right now, for unlimited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience. Go to Blinkist, that's Blinkist.com/success, and try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist. Thank you, Stuart. Stuart, I think there's a lot of really interesting stories in your book. And you know, many of them, of course, are about famous people, but they're not all the people are famous people. And I want you to tell the story, if you remember it, of Norma Hattelin. And it's a story in many respects like the story about the young woman that you talked about coming out of Somalia or wherever it was she was coming from. Norma's story is just as affecting because, you know, she's brought great goodness to the world over an enduring period of time from circumstances that, well, at some level were not exactly ideal, were they? Tell us a bit about her.
Oh, you know, I'm not sure that I can, because it slipped my memory at this moment. I didn't reread the book. Yeah, I'm sorry, Tim.
Well, she's the person. Let me help you with your memory, because she's the person who had been a prostitute in San Francisco,
yes.
I believe. There you go.
Yes.
All right. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it is. Well, again, it's one of those stories where there was some moment, I've forgotten what happened, but there was one of those aha moments, which sounds kind of like a cheap expression of what happened to somebody in those circumstances. But she realized that she, in fact, did have a choice of how she allowed people to treat her. There's a wonderful quote about Revlon. The Revlon kids were so poor, I think they grew up in Brooklyn, that they, in winter, went to school on alternate days because there was only one pair of shoes. And Charles Revlon was standing on a corner getting to cross the street, and he had this, it came to him that nobody could make him feel insecure without his consent, and he resolved to not give his consent. So if we fast forward to the question and Norma Hosling, you know, she realized that because of the narrative, her own personal narrative that she lived by, she didn't think she was entitled to be treated with respect and love and warmth. But she realized one day that that was the narrative that she'd bought into, but she didn't have to keep reading that narrative and acting it out. And in that moment, she just refused to give permission to allow herself to be treated that way, and then she turned her life around. But it's always that story where people realize that it's up to them. That doesn't mean that they're in it alone, because in a sense we're all in this together. But we are in it alone when it comes to making those internal decisions that we're going to be a victim or we're going to create something. And it's freeing up those creative juices in whatever way we do that, whether we're going to write or whether we're going to build a business, or we're going to be a great chef or a great barista or an engineer, a butcher, baker, candlestick maker. They're internal choices. And I think the other thing is that once you make that choice, you've really got to surround yourself with people who have chosen similarly. You know, most of us, you know, we want to change our lives, but we stay with all the people we've always been surrounded by. It's kind of like you're an alcoholic and the only job you can get is as a bartender. That's not a good place to practice the 12 steps, I'm just saying. So I think, you know, we did another book called Who's in Your Room?
Yeah,
and
if you're
going to take yourself on and say, okay, I'm not going to give people permission to treat me like the victim. I'm not going to let people sell me that I'm a victim. I'm not going to buy into that popular narrative. Once you say, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore, then you've got to look around yourself and say, okay, I need to be in the company of people who are committed to being builders, who are committed to being emotionally and spiritually and in terms of craftsmanship and skill, successful. And that's the big shift, because you've got to do it yourself, but you're not in this alone. So you've got to do the work. You've got to develop the skills. You've got to embrace what we call deliberate practice, which means you're going to do anything you do for a couple of reasons. One, you're going to do it to do it. You're going to do it to notice that you're able to get better at it as you're doing it. And you're going to do it to create value, that those things have to be met. You're going to invest in meaning. And I was talking to a great chef, and somebody said to me, "You know what you did with that restaurant? Is you got people to invest in the meaning of great food. You got people invested in making that meaningful." And this is the guy who started a restaurant called Nomas in Copenhagen, considered at the time the second best restaurant on earth, Noma. And so that meaning is a personal thing. You've got to make it meaningful. So you need to be around people who invest their resource of meaning in whatever it is they've chosen to do, and to do it to develop skills and mastery.
And Stuart, you talk about in the book, one of the great concepts that comes from Built to Last, the first of the two books, and that is the tyranny of the or and the genius of the and. And, you know, it's a phrase I use a lot with people when they get to a point where they say, "Oh, that can't be done." Well, you know, or they box themselves in more appropriately, typically box themselves into a sort of an either or supposition when really, you know, and the works. So talk a little bit about what that all means, all that particular kind of gobbledygook. What does that mean? And why is it so powerful?
Well, people say, "Well, I can, you know, I can either be happy, or I have to work really hard, make money, get my kids through college. Like that's an either or choice. And what about, well, if I was brought happiness to my workplace, I actually would be even more able to meet my family responsibilities that I've taken on." So, if you look at great companies, some companies say, "Well, I can only play for the bottom line. I've got to choose between the bottom line today or long-term growth and sustainability for the future." And in Built to Last, they said it's a both deal. So, I have a friend who's a motivational speaker. He's an extraordinarily good guitarist and very funny guy, Mike Rayburn. And he would go into companies and sing this song when they were doing these intensives. And he'd say, "Well, why don't we do this?" And I said, "Oh, we can't do that." He said, "Well, I know you can't do that, but what if you could?" That's a great question, because the moment you say, "But what if you could?"
That's a great question. Yeah.
People would start talking about what would happen if you could, and before you know what happens next, they're investing in the could instead of the can't. So the tyranny of the either or is this belief that there's one side of that you're stuck with, that you're committed to, and you can't start to embrace the other possibility. So if we go back to this person, "Well, you know, I got this job, I don't like all that well, so, you know, I can't pursue something I'd love to do." Well, that's an either or box you put yourself in. Tom Clancy said, "Well, it's a both and. I can be responsible in the family business and I can write." Well, it turned out to be the genius of the and for him, because it turned out pretty well. But if you look at a lot of people, you know, somebody asked me one day, "You know, why did you start your own business?" I said, "Well, I think of the business I was in, the profession I was in, I'd pretty much become unemployable. So I had to start my own business, you know." And you know, that old saying that rolling stones gather no moss. Well, I think that's a terrible narrative too. That's a kind of tyranny of the or, because, you know, for me, I've pursued a life of sequential curiosities, and some of them being all at the same time. And I've pursued the things I'm really curious about. And I've gotten good enough at enough of them to gather enough moss on the rolling stone that is me to be, you know, a happy camper. So I think the either or conversation is, it's not just one thing.
Yeah, I think, Stuart, you know, the beauty of the genius of the and is that the and unlocks the abundance mentality, doesn't it?
Correct. Yeah. If I'm a victim, there's no or.
The key, yeah. There's no or. You know, there's no and if I'm a victim. It's just, there's just, you know, oppressors and oppressed.
Yes.
You know, which is why that kind of, articulation never leads to any, building anything. It always leads to, you know, something that is the tyranny of the or. So it's, interesting. Stuart, you know, on page 127 of the book, there's a great phrase by Lao Tzu, and it's a very important part of the section in the book about action styles. And it, Lao Tzu's quote is, and I'll read it here, is, gain is the edge of loss. Loss is the heart of gain. Having many difficulties perfects the being. Having no difficulties ruins the being. Now, you know, lots of people talk about the importance of failure. Lots of people talk about, you know, character building through failure, blah, blah, blah. It all sounds altogether cliched after some time. But you discovered that Lao Tzu's quote is really embedded into the action styles of builders, that they are continuously learning. And many of the learnings, in fact, the best learnings come from the things that they failed at because, frankly, you know, experience is the best teacher. Talk more about that and how important it really is and the fact that it's not a cliche to say that you failed at something and that was good, that it was good that came from that.
So I think that we get hooked into the fact that if we fail once we're a failure, other than the alternative point of view, the genius of the end, you could look at it this way. Yes, it's true that you failed this time, and you could get to try that again and see if you make any progress. So that's the choice. And what you look at with people, say you're learning to play golf. Let's look at this idea of deliberate practice. Mm-hmm. People who go out and get a bucket of balls and hit the bucket of balls in the general direction of the green can hit 500 balls and not get better at it. They can hit 500 balls every day and not get better at it. But if you go out to hit a bucket of balls every day, and every day you say, you measure how close you get to the tee or how close you get to the hole on the tee every time, then you start to notice whether you're making progress. So it's what we call deliberate or mindful practice, where you're hitting the ball and you are committed to noticing that you're getting better at hitting the ball. So you could say in golf, unless you hit a hole in one, every other stroke is a failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the goal, I mean, golf is crazy. I mean, imagine I go up to you, Tim, and say, I've invented this incredible game. And you say, what is it? Well, you take this little ball, it's got dimples all over it, and you've got to get in a hole 100 yards away. Now, you've got to
300, 400, 500 yards away. Yeah.
Right. You've got to make that meaningful. You've got to make that empty hole the most important hole, the most meaningful hole on the planet at this moment. And then you say, okay, you say to me, okay, Stuart, I'll play. So you go out there and you hit the crap out of the ball 100 times on the way to getting the hole. And you lose. And I say, well, you lost him because you've got to try and do it in just one stroke. And you look at me and say, what kind of game is it if the guy has the most fun beating the crap out of the ball loses? And I say, yeah, I know, that doesn't seem like it's fair. Remember, the Scots invented golf to get back at the rest of the world for some imagined wrong, I guess. Just saying. So,
it does seem that way, doesn't it, Stuart?
It does.
I played a lot in the early 90s. It drove me out of my mind. I mean, really. It drove me out of my mind.
But if you think at it that way, every time you hit the ball to the single in the hole, you failed. Right? Because the goal is always the same, to get the ball in the hole. So the good golfers fail fewer times on the way to the goal of getting the ball in the hole. And the golfers who fail the fewer number of times win the Masters. But notice, they all fail most of the time because nobody scores 18. So you wouldn't have failed in golf if you got 18. Now, how many strokes you have before you get to the end of the 18 holes is a measure of how many times you failed. That's a different way to look at life. I'm into food and coffee these days. I know a lot of good chefs. And I was talking to a local chef who I like a bunch. And he says, it's really tough for a home cook to get any good. And I said, why is that? He said, well, you know, they get a cookbook. They cook a recipe once, it probably sucks. Never cook it again. He said, now, in my kitchen, I got like half a dozen line chefs. We'll cook that meal 150 times tonight. Somewhere along the way, you get really, 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 really good at it. And he said, you know, we have a staff dinner every night. Well, it's nice to feed everybody, but the other thing we do is we look at all the ways we screwed that meal up at the staff dinner and how are we going to make sure we don't screw it up before it goes out to somebody who ordered it in the restaurant. He says, one of the things we like about food is if you fail the first time you cook a dish, you can cook it again pretty quickly until you get it right. And he said, so you can be cooking a meal and you look and say, we failed, and that one goes in the trash. Now, if you do that too often, you've destroyed your margins. But I don't think people understand that great chefs fail more often than home chefs. But on the other hand, mm-hmm. they learn a lot more because they've got a deliberate practice of getting better at it every time. It's what Thomas Keller, one of the world's great chefs, calls you develop finesse. You learn how to elevate what you're doing to a higher level. And so that's my thing about failure, that it's
that's fabulous, Stuart. You know, and you see that I live, as you know, in Austin, Texas, and you know, Mexican food here is fabulous. But you know what? You go to San Antonio, it's more fabulous. And I'm told if you go to El Paso, it's like going to heaven.
Now, why is it different?
You know, people, well, this thing, you know, Austin's about 15%, you know, Mexican American. San Antonio's 65% Mexican American, and El Paso's about 55% Mexican American as well. Well, you know what? The folks that have been cooking this stuff, many of those owners of those restaurants have been doing it for 50 years. And by the way, the people eating it know what's good and what isn't.
Well, that's another quality that we haven't talked about yet. And I don't know that we talked about it in the book, but I found that one of the prerequisites to getting world class or at anything, or really, really good at anything, is to know what good tastes like, or looks like, or feels like, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. is like. Because I've been teaching people to make espresso, right? How hard can this be? Well, it turns out they're making what they call a God shot. They call it a God shot because you lift up the espresso, you take a sip, and you say, oh, God, it's a God shot. So it turns out the hardest thing to do in coffee is to pull a great espresso shot every time. In fact, nobody can pull a God shot every time. There's so many variables. But when I start out the class, I'll say your biggest hurdle is you may never have tasted a great shot of espresso in your life. It's highly improbable that you'll get one at Starbucks. It's all done with super automatics, and they're very cost conscious about what they pay for the beans with that environment. And I would argue they're not in the coffee business, they're in the coffee flavored milk business. But that's another thing. So I'll say, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull a lousy shot and a good shot in no particular order. And you're going to taste them. And so I give them a shot that's not very good, but it's as good as Starbucks or Pete's. And I'll say, oh, yeah, it's okay. It's all right. And then I make a really bad one. Well, I know it's really bad. And then I make them a great shot, the best one I'm capable of making at that given moment in time. I'm not a world-class barista, but I'm pretty good. And they'll just light up. And then I start teaching them. And they'll say, well, is this a good shot? I say, I don't know. You taste it. And they'll say, well, how do I know? I said, well, does it bring you pleasure? Yeah, I like this. I said, good, then it's a good shot. So a couple of things you got to do. You got to teach people to know what good is. And then you've got to encourage them to trust themselves that if what they just did fills them with pleasure, it's a good one. And if they do that often enough, they'll start to do something that fills other people with pleasure. And then people look at you and say, you know, you're a good one. I think Abe Lincoln was right. It was good of the Chinese to steal it and put it in a fortune cookie. It was great advice that Ed Panowitz gave to his graduate students and then gave to me that day when he said, you know, I think the success built to last is the motto, whatever you are, be a good one. If you commit yourself to that, to being a good one, it's going to turn out for you. It really is. And I found that to be true. I try to be a good one every day at whatever I'm doing.
And the good ones, Stuart, and I'm going to tell you a story of my own, a little one, but I think it's emblematic of many of the threads of what you're talking about. The good ones, not only do they, you know, they try to do their best, and they bring joy because of that, but they take such great pride when others recognize it. My daughter, as you know, lives in San Antonio, and there's a place down in San Antonio that serves something called a puffy taco. And puffy tacos are only served in two places on earth, three places, one place in northern Mexico and two places in San Antonio. And I read about it in Texas Monthly, and I said to my daughter, Mackenzie, we have to go there. So I drove 125 miles to go down to San Antonio to go to get a puffy taco. And it was the most fabulous thing I've ever eaten. It was unbelievable. I mean, and so with the wait, and by the way, it's car hop service, Stuart. It was, you know, from the 1950s, which is, you know, another level of this greatness. But the car hop lady, the waitress, I told her how wonderful this was, this food, and how much pleased I was that I drove all the way from Austin. Well, she was so happy that someone had driven all that way. She had to tell me the entire history of the place and who owned it and this and that. And literally, you know, I've had that experience 100 times in restaurants around the United States, around the world for that matter, particularly in ethnic restaurants in places like Greece and London and here in the United States. And they are so happy that you recognize that what they do is important, because it is important. It's a great thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So you're adding to their account of meaning. Mm-hmm. You're putting meaning. You're dropping a coin of meaning in their piggy bank of knowing that they matter.
Yes, and as they have in my piggy bank, by being good ones.
Correct. Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you talk about them adding, you know, the good ones, the builders, they add goodness to the world. And, you know, I'll talk about that experience for the rest of my life because it is, you know, it was great. You know, not only just the food, but the people, too.
Remember when we went to the barbecue place with Ross Perot? I still got this photograph.
I do too.
That was one of the like silver box memories of our life that week with Ross, right? Ross Perot, one of the great ones.
It's a great one indeed, and there's a lot of stories there. Stuart, you know, as we round round this out here, there's one thing I do want you to talk a little bit more about. And you mentioned the word once or twice early in the conversation. And you've certainly talked about some of the joys of it. And it is mastery. And whatever that mastery might be, whether it's a beautiful yard in your around your house or a beautiful garden or, you know, being a really good parent, it doesn't have to be world beating, but I think that, you know, that's a really good place to end, which is, you know, you could give us a couple of paragraphs on why mastery matters so much. And I think in the book that you talk about mastery in the chapter where you use the Yoda from Star Wars quote, which is, do or not do. There is no try.
Yes. So people say, well, how do you know when you've achieved mastery? What I've noticed is people have crossed the threshold of the door into the room of mastery about that time where they've taken what they've learned from their mentors, from the people who've offered them education and enlightenment in the field that they are interested in. And when you start out studying to get good at something, you spend a lot of time copying the person who taught you, trying to do what they told you to do. Mm-hmm. And there's that moment where your skills are improving and you move from the space of, shall we say, imitating your mentors to infusing your action with your own spirit, with your own individual nature, with your own uniqueness. This sounds like gobbledygook. I don't mean it to. But there's a moment where your own spirit and the way in which you are slightly different from everybody else fills what it is you're doing. And these are these moments where you feel in a state of flow, when you feel at one with the universe. I know it sounds like this hopeless human potential stuff, but that doesn't mean it isn't so. And when people step into that moment, they've achieved a level of mastery, that they have an individual expression of their own goodness at doing something. So Steph Curry doesn't quite launch a ball the way Michael Jordan did or LeBron James. People might say, well, LeBron James is the greatest basketball player in the world. But people might say Steph Curry is the best shooter we've ever seen. So they're both masters in a sport. And their expression of that mastery differs. And that's what mastery takes, when your own spirit, when your own, I don't know what other word, your own soulfulness gets to be in everything that you do. What you do is a container of that as you offer it to the world. That's what mastery takes. And it takes a lot of repetition. But this is the other thing that I've found. I notice that once people commit themselves to a path of achieving mastery, once they commit themselves to a path of being a good one, whatever it is they're being in the moment, being a good one in this moment, being the best at it they can possibly be at it in this moment, their life changes. It just changes. They experience themselves differently. You just experience yourself differently. And at that level, it's a different conversation. I notice that when people who are masters in a field come together, the fields can be incredibly different. The level of conversation is extraordinary. It's real. It's authentic. Nobody's trying to prove anything to anybody else. There's love in it. There's spirit in it. There's joy in it. It's really special. And so if you commit yourself to being a good one on a path to being almost looks like effortlessly good at it, because you watch those great athletes, somehow it seems easier, or you look at a great chef turning out a meal. It looks easy, but it's that simplicity on the other side of complexity that they've arrived at that represents the fact that they've achieved mastery. So you get up every day, you do what you do, you invest meaning in what you do, and you find a way to measure your progress so you know you're getting better at it. And one day you'll be a master. But on every day between now and then, you'll experience yourself as a more successful person, and you'll be a happier person. There'll be days when you're frustrated too, but on balance, your life will be moving in the direction of goodness.
Yeah, and I think it also, Stuart, I would add, it becomes a feedback, a virtuous feedback loop, frankly.
Absolutely.
By that I mean, by way of story, I would say that there have been a couple of days when I've gotten on podcasts and I just felt miserable. You know, one of those days when you wake up in the morning and it's like, what in God's name, they, you know, hit me over the head. And then I get on my podcast with somebody that's really interesting. And all of a sudden, I'm alive and awake. And it's amazing to me. Nothing's changed, except I'm in the midst of a great conversation with somebody. And by the way, you know, improving the craft that, you know, I'm now part of, which is interviewing folks. You also, something, Stuart, you said that reminds you, remember that book we did with Kevin Elko? And for those of you
in
podcast land,
yeah.
Kevin Elko.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for those of you out there in podcast land, you know, Kevin's basically the guy who invented sports psychology, you know, and if you wanted a little ditty on him, but he had this great phrase that, so important, you know, I think, you know, in fact, I'll start the phrase, and my kids who are now 24 and 30 will roll their eyes and say, yes, Dad, but they know it, but they do know it's important, which is, it all happens over a long period of time, all of a sudden.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. Yes. That's how mastery is.
That's how mastery works. There's no overnight sensations.
We wrote that little book with Elko called Touched Out. Remember that?
Yes, we did.
And he was working with the New Orleans Saints, and that book became required reading that year for the New Orleans Saints. And they won the Super Bowl. Hey, how cool is that? We made a small contribution there.
Well, you know, he has 6 or 7 Super Bowl rings from, you know, working with teams. In fact, when my son was young and was talking to Kevin on a regular basis, he would say to Kevin, you know, who are you working with next season? And Kevin would tell him, and Zach would go and, you know, call a bookie and bet on that team. And, put money on it. And the 3 times, you know, he won big. Probably not supposed to tell that story, but there you have it. My kid was an entrepreneur at a young age. I'm sure his mother doesn't know about that.
She
will now.
She will now, that's right. She probably isn't going to listen, but whatever. Your secret's probably
safe. No, she's actually listening to these, Stuart, and reading the newsletter that we have. But, Stuart, kept you a long time, but it's always it's always a great pleasure, you know, even when we're just talking and, you know, together when there's nobody listening. And so thanks again. And for those of you out in podcast land, this won't be the last time you'll hear from Stuart. we're going to line up some people that he or and or I will interview that will knock your socks off. And you know, Stewart's as good an interviewer as he is a pontificator, I guess is the right word, Stewart.
But, I don't know, pontificator. It sounds like a condemnation. I hope I'm.
Yes, I know. I said it for a reason to boast your chops, but. I mean, he's a great interviewer, but you know, there's a lot of things Stewart's really, really great at. And so listen, now all of you out there in podcast land, I hope that you've enjoyed this. Remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, which I think is, you know, filled with fun information about our future guests and lots of stories that have been told in it. And I've gotten a lot of really good feedback that, you know, the people who do register really, really enjoy it. Frankly, from people all over the world at this point, and go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, et cetera, and rate our show, please. Till the next time, go out there and live the best version of you. Stewart, thank you.
Tim, thanks for having me. It's great. Bye.
So let me tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, and it could work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, or lunch break, or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg. Two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist.